Let's call this meeting to order of the Local Government Committee. We have a quorum. So Representative Stern, do you want to move the minutes from the last minute meeting?
Sure, I'll move the minutes there. Move the minutes there, Chair.
Any questions or all in favor of the minutes then? Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Representative Champion, are you here?
Yes.
House File 644. I'll move the bill. Chair moves House File 644 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations Reform and Technology and Elections. Representative Champion, would you wish to explain your bill?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Really, I just want to tell you a couple things that I believe that the committee has an opportunity to empower cities by strengthening the economic base by hiring a certain a number of city residents. This bill improves the quality of life for residents and our state by promoting homegrown or city residents in the performance of contracts or projects. Now, this legislation, I'll be the first to say, it has a lot that is going to be changed potentially or just addressed as it goes through the various stages, and so I'm open to that. Now, the bill in front of you really is as a condition, it outlines as a condition of performance work under a public works contract or service contract or a subsidized project, a statutory city may, by ordinance, require the entity that contracts with the city to hire a certain number or percentage of city residents or low-income residents in the performance of the contract. That's what the contract or legislation is really all about. It's really about empowering people. And I did bring along just a couple people that could also help talk about how they've seen this sort of initiative launched and how it has worked during the project. So the first person that I would like to welcome is, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any witnesses there?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I have Elizabeth Campbell. Elizabeth is with Ryan Companies from Minneapolis, and she can talk a little bit about work that they've done under these sort of standards.
State your name for the record and tell us who you're with. And
Elizabeth Campbell, Ryan Companies, my Emerging Business Inclusion Coordinator. And Bobby asked me to come and talk with you about the Midtown Exchange Project. Are you familiar with that project in the corner of Chicago and Lake? That project had resident hiring goals of 25 to 30, and in the end we were able to hire 45 residents on the project.
Any other projects that you...
Yes, and we also have Super Target Midway, which is not a funded project,
mm-hmm.
but a high-visibility urban project. And the city of St. Paul asked us to implement resident hiring goals on that project. The goal was 8 to 10, and we hired 26 residents for that project. The resident hiring was structured by zip code. Midtown Exchange had contiguous zip codes, and Super Target Midway had low-income zip codes throughout the whole city.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Any questions about the bill that for the Representative Taylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Champion. Have you spoken with the city of Minneapolis? I'm sorry, I missed a short piece of this. So if I'm repeating something, but if you've spoken with the city of Minneapolis that you represent, or the League of Minnesota Cities, and gotten their feelings about the bill.
Representative Champion,
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I have had an opportunity to talk briefly with the city of Minneapolis. They are not taking any position on the bill right now. They believe that if there are any, well, if there's a need to have any amendments, that they believe that there's a step in the process where they will be able to talk with me about that and for us to work together on that. I have not had an opportunity to talk with the League of Cities, just so that I can fairly represent that.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up, and Representative Champion, if you could just, my concern, I'm able to support the bill, provided that it's enabling ordinance, which I read that it is, or enabling statute. And so I just hope that we can keep it that way and then continue to talk about the impact on our cities. And as just you gather more information, I'm always a fan, actually, of enabling ordinances, or generally, I should say. I'm sure I'll vote against one now that I said it almost always. I would just want to make sure that it's enabling ordinance and until we can really know about the impact in these very, very tough times. We want to make sure that we can indeed put folks to work and that they're folks who live in the city and the communities that they serve, but want to make sure we're not tying the hands of our local units of government in the meantime. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, yes, it's an enabling statute, and we made it flexible so that cities can work with their constituencies and their unique circumstances so that they can do something that is impactful. And we believe that this legislation will put us on that track of empowerment.
Representative Eastland, did you have your hand up? Or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is there something currently in law or something that would prohibit cities or home rule charters from doing this now?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Champion.
Representative, from my understanding, there's nothing at this particular time that would prohibit it that I know of.
Representative Eastland.
I guess then my question is why do we need this? I mean, if a city can go down this road now and all this is enabling legislation that says may, they can do this if they want to. Quite frankly, they can do it if they want to right now. I mean, so what? I mean, we have statute books that are miles thick. I mean, why are we adding information that really does nothing except confirm what people can already do? I guess why should we do this?
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are several reasons why I believe it's important for us to do it. Number one, it encourages cities to think about inclusion and think about inclusion in a different way. Number two, it supports true economic development so that all residents are truly intentionally looked upon as a viable and a valuable resource when we think in terms of revenue generation. Number three, I think it's important for the state of Minnesota from a legislative perspective to send forward what we believe to be important guiding principles, and that guiding principle of inclusion, that guiding principle of true support and economic development. And you're right, it also says that perhaps that they can, but we believe that along the way, when there's the unified support that pushes us towards inclusion and participation of all residents, we believe that that's an important guiding principle or an important public policy for us to articulate and for us to stand by.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it says in here that what we're talking about basically are contracts with the city to hire certain percentage of residents to perform certain contract projects. Why wouldn't it also be appropriate that then the city should basically use the same standard for all of the employees that the city hires? Why is it just for contracts that are being brought to the table at this point?
Well, let me say,
Representative Campion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it's important for us to think about it totally, because when we think in terms of inclusion and that public dollars are used for these projects, those are the contracts that we believe to be important and placed on the table today. That does not prohibit you as legislators or us as legislators in expanding that notion if we believe that it was important to do so. But the legislation today centers around this narrow focus, and we believe that this will have the greatest impact when we think in terms of inclusion.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess you kind of said a key word that I think is in there. You talked about public dollars. And it would seem that if contractors who are people who are bidding on jobs to provide for the city, we should be concerned that the public dollars that are being spent are getting the most efficient use and delivering us the product at the best price. And I guess my question is when we have some highly technical kinds of projects, when we have things that require expertise, and then there's a requirement to meet a certain quota of hiring someone that may or may not have those qualifications, how would a city or how would somebody respond to that, or how could a private contractor respond to that if they were trying to put together a project for the most efficient amount of dollars and deliver the best use of public funds?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Campbell.
And Representative, I'm going to let Elizabeth Campbell from Ryan answer that question.
In the case of a construction project in the Twin Cities metro area, those typically would be union jobs. And here we're talking, this would have an impact on unemployed union trade workers. So they would already be well-trained, highly qualified workers who happen to live in the zip codes or in the targeted area for which you're trying to hire residents.
I have one follow-up, and I think this kind of ties in with that. Then in the bill, it talks about low income. What is the definition of low income? Is that an unemployed union worker, or is that a what is the standard for low income? I'm not sure what that is, what it could mean. Can any city define it? What would be the standard for that term?
Representative Campion.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, well, each city will have an opportunity to look at the notion and the notion of low income and define it, because I believe that it needs to have some uniformity, but we want to get some flexibility so that governments or municipalities have the flexibility to think about how they want to structure an ordinance that their city is going to respond to and follow. And so that's why you see the legislation says the definition of low income is something that will be defined by that ordinance that they will create as a way of making sure that they have this whole notion or the guiding principles of inclusion put on the table. And I'm going to also let Elizabeth Campbell speak to that as well.
Ms. Campbell.
In the city of St. Paul for the Super Target Midway project, they identified census tracts or low-income zip codes to justify the zip code choice. So it's typically, and zip code actually can be used as a proxy for income. It's typically, low-income people typically do live in the same general area. So if you choose a zip code, you are going to be able to target a certain income group.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a I don't know that it's a correct assumption to say that because someone lives in a certain jurisdiction and they fit the definition of whatever poverty is or whatever low income is in that jurisdiction, that should trump somebody that lives 20 miles away that works for the contractor that maybe is also sitting on the bench that's maybe also wanting to get a job and get to work for his boss. You know, I don't think where you live should necessarily be the predominant characteristic of whether or not you can work. I think diversity can happen in a variety of ways, and we can have that same diversity by giving contractors the ability to hire the people that are their employees. And so I guess I just listen to the bill and I look at what we have here. And I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me that we're adding statutory language for something that can already happen, that cities can already do. Private contractors can already do this if it's something that works real well. And I just think it's a step in the direction of government regulation that we should not be really taking right now.
Thank you, Representative Eastland. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Campion, for bringing this forward. I guess to the question around, you know, why is this needed, I want to let members know that in the Transportation Committee, there was a provision in the omnibus bill directing MnDOT to do a study of the workforce development and some of their contracts. And I think, you know, there's a lot of concern out there in the community that there are public entities that are falling flat and falling short on this. And so I think anything that at least helps in the accountability process is important. And
I wanted to thank you for bringing up the Midtown Exchange. That's not in my district, but it's very close, and it's a very, very successful project. So I think we see what can happen when the community is fully engaged in these projects. So thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Representative Champion. Thank you, Representative. Thank you for those comments. And I think to make it a lot clearer as to the groups that are falling through the cracks, or individuals who are hardworking, who are equally as qualified, that are falling through the cracks, I'd like to call Mr. Roosevelt Gaines to be able to speak briefly to that question, because he works with the Minneapolis Urban League.
Mr. Gaines, can you give your full name for the and your position for the...
Roosevelt Gaines, and I'm the trade specialist at Minneapolis Urban League, and my job is to work with the contractors to get them to hire minorities and women on their projects. First of all, I'd like to just kind of go back to your comment. Sure, there are things that are already in place with the contractors and the city and some of those agencies, but they're not meeting them. They're not meeting. If you went down the line right now to every governmental agency, you can do MnDOT, you can do Metropolitan Airport Commission, you can do the Park Board, you can do across the board, and if you looked at all of those, they have not been inclusive of minorities and women from the north side or south Minneapolis. They have not met their goals at all. So, I want to commend Bobby for bringing this bill forward, because I think it just adds on to something that really needs to happen from this side of the river over here at the state capitol, that could send a message to the local city governments that, you know, when are we going to start to be inclusive of everybody and start leaving people out of these projects? And I see it all the time. You know, I see... contractors in North Minneapolis, you know, putting down concrete or laying pipe, and they don't have any representation at all from the community. You know, and I'm not saying leave other people out, and I work real close with all the building trades and the unions, and I'm the Urban League is the only agency that's invited to attend the building trades meeting every Wednesday morning, so I work real close with those guys, and they have supported the LEAP program for over 40 years, so there has to be a good relationship between the Urban League and the building trades and the community, and, you know, there's just got to be something that's put in place to help people get jobs in our communities, and right now they're being left out, and we see it every day at the Urban League when people come in and say, God, is someone doing some work down the street from us, and we don't see anybody from the community. So this is a chance for people at the state to send a good message to the city and the local government agencies that, you know, we really need to be some compliance rules. Even with the stuff that Bobby has here, there's got to be some compliance stuff that's put in there to make sure that people are complying, because I see too often where they put on paper that we're going to meet goals and they don't do it, and no one holds them accountable. I think it should be three strikes and you're out. If you don't meet a state contract, you know, once or twice, then there should be some type of penalty in for it. So, you know, I see it every day. You know, I'm out there, and I want to commend Ryan Companies again. You know, Elizabeth and Ryan Company. There's some other contractors out there that meet their goals and hire people. You know, that's about what I have to say.
Mr. Gaines, you've worked with the Ryan Corporation. You've worked with the building trades. Is this a program to help people in these areas, these zip codes or these communities, to be able to get up and out of poverty by getting training,
absolutely,
their jobs and getting into the trades and getting into some good paying jobs?
What I do is, if someone comes to me and say they want to be a carpenter, I take that person, find them a job, whether it's with Ryan or any other contractor. Then I take that individual, get him signed up with the apprenticeship program. We pay the tools, we pay for the tools, the equipment, and work booth. We provide any first month's union dues. We pick up the initiation fee. So the goal is to remove all the barriers for those individuals so that they can start their job the first day when they are on the job. So they become a union worker as soon as they go on to the project.
And then
Mr. Gaines, do they get training then through the apprenticeship program?
They get training through the apprenticeship.
A better paying job in the future.
Absolutely. One of the things that folks ask me all the time is, why doesn't the Urban League get into training? And I tell them that we don't get into training because we have a good relationship with the building trades, and we are not interested in duplicating the service that the building trades already do through their apprenticeship program.
Representative Dixon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In listening to this bill and hearing it characterized as an enabling legislation, I think that's a little bit mischaracterization, because for it to be enabling legislation, there has to be some ban or some prohibition that the legislation is now enabling. But absent that, I do believe that this is really nothing more than additional words in an already 15 books, 3-inch thick set of statutes that we already have to live under. So I am concerned that we're moving forward with language that really has no purpose. Right now, municipalities can do this. So it sounds like some have. But the problem isn't then the ability to create these ordinances. It sounds like it's a problem in enforcement of said ordinances. This language does not get to the issue that's been brought forward, and so I think there probably has to be another stab at it. A couple of entities that have been listed by the testifier, MnDOT, Metropolitan Airports, other state agencies, and I understand the concern and I'm empathetic, but this bill doesn't get to those concerns because this bill talks specifically about home rule and statutory cities. So it sounds like there's a concern out there. I have a concern that this bill doesn't get to the concern that's out there. Mm-hmm. Right? Again, there probably has to be another shot at it. My concern, as this bill moves forward, and it's a concern I bring to you, Mr. Chairman, I understand why this bill is being heard first in this committee, because it does talk about local governments and what this legislature is ready to move on with local governments. Right now, there's no concern. But, Mr. Chairman, if, as this bill moves forward, this changes from enabling language to a mandate upon local governments, Mr. Chairman, I would think it'd be quite appropriate for the chair of this committee to immediately recall that bill back to this committee so that we can get testimony from the local governments which would be immediately affected by the mandates. Mr. Chair, would that be your intention?
Think about that question. I would say if it did change from an enabling language to a mandate, and with the work we're doing with the work group that Representative Lanning is doing, I would think we want to have it back here to see, because if it would have a mandate, it would have a cost to local government. The enabling language is allow them to do it, and I think that's a good idea to allow them to do it and say that they can do it, so there's no question. I think there's some concern. From what I've read, is that cities have had problems where they're concerned about this. The two projects that were talked about here, I know a little bit about because in my field outside of here, they came from by agreements with the contractor and the cities, with the and the people in the neighborhood to get the developments going. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some concern that if they tried to do this citywide or do this otherwise, that there would be problems or could be problems. So I think that's why they're seeking the language.
Mr. Chen?
Thank you. Mr. Representative Dixon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do appreciate the fact and do believe that you're moving forward thoughtfully, that if there was a mandate put into, amended into this language, that it then be brought back to this committee. I do appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Champion, I just had a question about the language on 1.9. It talks about to hire a certain number or percentage of city residents or low-income residents. So in other words, then, if the percentage was met by city residents, then the low-income residents would not have to be hired? There's an or in there on line 1.10.
Mr. Chair, Representative, a part of the consideration around the language was to give the cities some guidance and that they would have some flexibility along with its process to flesh out exactly what their ordinance should be. And that's why you didn't have the conjunction and, but you have or. And so that's why we wanted to make sure that it's one or the other. And again, providing that flexibility where a municipality could say, well, we want to make sure that there's inclusion of both, if that's what they want to do. But again, it's to give some flexibility to the
representative.
And then you had talked about, there's a lot of talk here about hiring union labor, but it doesn't really say that here in the bill. It doesn't really say in the bill that they would be qualified either. So I'm wondering, did you on purpose take out the word qualified? Because it would seem that the percentage of it should be qualified city residents or qualified low-income residents. And I'm wondering if there was a reason you did that, because it doesn't say that they would be union and trained. This bill doesn't say that.
Representative Champion. Mr. Chair, Representative, we intentionally didn't put the word qualified in there because we all believe that they would be qualified in order to do the job, you know. And so that was the reason why that particular word was not placed in there, that it would be assumed that they would be qualified.
Representative Kelsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just seems a little, I don't know, maybe there's somebody that would have, you know, when you say it's assumed, I don't assume that when I see the law. So that's just a little bit of a problem that I see with it. I think it should be tightened up to say what you're actually saying that it says, but it doesn't really say it on this page.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Champion.
Representative. And that point is well taken. Those are some considerations that we are going to wrestle with as this legislation hopefully moves throughout our process. Again, I want to make sure that I'm having some real-time discussions with unions, a variety of different people, even different cities, so that we can make sure that we are responsive to their needs as long as the guiding principles are not subverted by some other changes. But we will take that into consideration. And I agree that there's always some additional language that we could put in there. But again, I trust the process and trust that it's going to go through the necessary challenges in order to make sure that we get some final language that would be appropriate and impactful.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi kind of touched on one of my thoughts. I don't even know if it's a concern yet. I'm just trying to get my thought process around what this then means, because I think this is trying to guarantee an outcome, and we've been used to working with opportunity here at the moment. But maybe my question is more for you, because you have experience as a business agent for one of the trades and know how the trades work. I'm trying to determine what it would be like for a this frankly is almost like a Minneapolis or St. Paul project. I think I could see those cities arguing over something like this more so than a city I represent. But nonetheless, let's suppose Minneapolis puts a public works contract into place. Most of the people that work in there are in project labor agreements. They're all union shops, things like that. How practically speaking, how would this work? How would somebody who hires from the union hall, has to go through apprenticeship programs, serve time to become a journeyman, to be qualified to do cement work, brick work, steel work, pick your trade. How is this going to work to move into a neighborhood and all of a sudden have to let some people stand at the union hall to hire people who might fit somebody's preconceived notion of somebody who's downtrodden or something like that, that is deserving of this kind of an outcome? You follow me? I'm trying to understand how this is going to work when some guys are still standing at the union hall and we hire, just because we happen to be working in a certain neighborhood, we hire folks from the neighborhood. I'm sensing all kinds of problems here. That's what I'm sensing.
Actually, Representative Beard, I've dealt with having to deal with this, and
which is why my question is.
It has not been a barrier. I mean, we've had a couple jobs that have been mentioned here that I know about. That the Sears Tower building, the renovation there, the hospital in South Minneapolis that we've had, that where they had requirements for people in certain zip codes, got preference to getting hired there because they had some quotas to meet some goals to meet to have people hired from the community. It also allowed, which is how I've envisioned this, and I think we've worked with Mr. Gaines here, with the Urban League, we worked, the building trades that worked for years to try and get people from the low-income communities. It's a good way to get them up and out of poverty, get them training in the building trades, and move them from poverty into the middle class. And so this is something we've worked with them, and this has been a tool that they've used on certain projects that put these goals on there, that these hiring goals that have helped get people from those communities, give them a chance to get into the trades, get into the training, to get staff, to get into better paying jobs in the future. So I've seen it working, and it has not been onerous for the trades to do this.
Okay. Is then the mandate that a city would lay on, does that go on the trade unions, or does it go on the contractor? Does the contractor, if it is, I assume it's the latter, the contractor then has to renegotiate with the unions? Is that where because there's a law in place here, the contractor law, and that's what I'm wondering.
I think Ms. Campbell could probably answer that question, because she's dealt with it as far as from the side of a contractor. But normally it's on the contractor's agreement they have.
Okay.
Right. And in the case of Midtown Exchange, we were able to go to the trades that hire through a referral hall and ask them to grab the zip code. And we did that in advance of negotiation of the agreement. And then we drive all these things that we agreed to in the development agreement drive down to the subcontractors. So the first line is the union trades that go through the referral hall. However, a general contractor typically has strong relationships with its subcontractors, and we were able to hire residents throughout the trades.
Representative Beard.
Okay, I think I understand that question. I'm going to probably unfold a little more here as I listen to the debate. But so in this case, then, the union halls are willing to set aside the seniority premise to hire for other reasons then. And if these folks come on a payroll and actually begin to learn the trade, join the union, do they then subsequently get hired by seniority date or, again, for other reasons?
Representative Beard, most of the building trades that I'm familiar with do not have seniority language in their contract.
They don't. Okay.
It's based on the performance that the person does on the job. This gives them a leg up or a foot into the door, and allows them to, if they apply themselves going on in the future, that they would be able to then stay in the trades and they'd have to, you know, when this job is done, like any building trade job, as I've explained to some people in the past, it's a whole bunch of little projects you work on, and you build a 30-year career on that. And so this could be the leg, the foot in the door, and then once they're in the door, allow them to use their abilities and apply themselves, and they could create a career out of this by finishing the apprenticeship program and then going on and getting hired by other contractors in the future.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that explanation.
Any further questions? Representative Matt Lanning, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Champion. I'm sympathetic to the goal that you're trying to achieve here, as I understand it, to open up job opportunities to populations that are currently underrepresented in various trades or other opportunities that there may be. So I'm sympathetic to the goal, but this is not going to get you to that goal. And if this were in statute, it's not going to give any more impetus to achieving this goal than what is currently available to cities. And my feeling is that you ought to look at other strategies to achieve that goal. I don't think this is going to do it.
Representative Dixon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Champion. As a person who's been here for a while, I sometimes almost always have noticed that if you want to move forward an idea, it's better to take a small bite of the apple, piece at a time, rather than move forward with what essentially will be a statewide project. So I'm going to offer an amendment to Representative Champion and then speak to it and hope that you would agree that this might be a good first step. Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes, Representative Spence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move to amend House File 644 as follows. On page 1, line 8, after project, comma, strike the word a. After charter, strike the words or statutory city and insert cities of the first class. And, Mr. Chair, if I could speak to that.
Make sure we have it here. So the line would read, make sure I got this right, for subsidized projects, home rule charter cities of the first class, may by ordinance.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Champion. Again, as many people have mentioned, the empathy towards this issue, it plays out different in different parts of the state, I think. Rather than take a big slice, you're really interested in the place where we have higher densities of low-income students or low-income families, I would imagine, and of course those exist in cities of the first class. Now, I did speak with Ms. Dyson. All cities of the first class are home rule charter, right? So then if this legislation were to go into law, it would have the effect of really focusing it in a few places in the state, and then we'll see if it works. And those few places in the state would be Representative Champion, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth.
Representative Champion.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for your thoughts as it pertains to that friendly amendment. I would speak against that amendment because I believe that the way the language is crafted thus far, that yes, it's far-reaching, but it's intended to be far-reaching because I wanted to reach the rural areas as well, up on the Iron Range. I wanted to reach not just there, but throughout, so that residents of those wonderful smaller cities also have the benefit of participating in the revenue stream of public contracts, and therefore it strengthens them as well as others. Yes, I would like for low income to be strengthened, but I also want the middle class to be strengthened. I want all Minnesotans to be strengthened, especially when we think in terms of public dollars. And so for that reason, I would speak against the amendment itself.
Representative Bisson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Champion. I do appreciate that, but I think I know District 35B probably better than hopefully other legislators here in the body, and I appreciate you caring about my residents. I just let you know I care about them as well.
Any questions? More questions about the amendment? Representative Turner?
Mr. Representative Biskins, I just was wondering, would Rochester be considered also one of the Class 1 cities? So it'll probably be addition to Duluth, but my understanding might be
Representative Biskins.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Dyson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Sterner, after the next federal bicentennial census, Rochester will be a first-class city, and I believe it is a home rule charter city, but at this time it is not a first-class city.
Thank you.
So, Representative Biskins, I have a question. Would this, this would be cities of the first class, so as I believe that'd be currently Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. That would exclude St. Cloud from being able to use this, Rochester, Wilmer, or any of the, maybe the more regional centers from using this as a tool to help their citizens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as we've heard through testimony, as we've heard from conversation, absolutely not. This is a tool they already have in the toolbox. This is enabling legislation that enables municipalities to do what they can already do. So, no, this excludes nobody and really affects nobody either, sorry to say.
Any other questions? So Representative Diskins moves an oral amendment to line 1.8. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. No's have. Does not prevail. Thank you. Representative Champion.
Due to time, I would just like to recognize Reverend Jerry McAfee, who is here, who is also going to testify. But because we only have half an hour, I want to be respectful of the committee's time, as well as Mr. Jim Frisco, who is the president of the National Association of Minority Contractors, as well as Mr. Smith, who's with Mad Dads. And I just wanted to recognize those other testifiers, but because of time, I know that we have to move forward.
Okay. Any further discussion? If not, the chair removes his motion for House File 644 to be passed and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government, Operations, Technology, and Elections. All in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. Motion prevails. Thank you. Next bill we have on today's calendar is House File 305. Representative Kalin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, excuse me.
Good evening,
Mr. Chair and members. I guess that includes Representative Winkler, who has declared that after 5 o'clock is evening. But
Representative Kalin, what would you like to do with your bill? What's your pleasure?
I would love for the committee to support my bill and move it along. So I guess my formal motion will be to move House File 305 and that this will be passed, hopefully as amended ultimately, and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations with further names in its title, chaired by Representative Kowalski. Reform Technology and Elections, and again, Representative Winkler will be finishing my sentences today.
Okay, Mr. Representative Kalin, go ahead and describe your bill. And members, there's some cookies here before you go. There's some cookies here that were provided by the committee aide, Christine Murphy, and so eat up and...
Mr. Chair and members, just as the cookies do, my bill hopes to sweeten the pot for land use conservation in townships and in counties and cities across the state. Currently, transfer of development credits are allowed, as you'll see, under both the county and municipal zoning ordinances. However,
Representative Kalin, you have an amendment here. Do you want to do that first? And
I thought I would finish with the description of the bill and then do the amendment, if that's okay.
Okay.
I think it will provide a little more context and background for the amendment. Currently, in Chisago County, and I'm going to speak about Chisago County because it's the case I know best, just as Representative Diskins knows District 35B the best, hopefully. Currently, if you live in a township, you are able to develop one unit for every 5 acres in your parcel. So if you own 100 acres, you can develop 20 units in that parcel and have a plat approved. That right to develop, we often don't really think of as an absolute right. It's more implicit. But explicitly, county zoning density ordinances establish that right. So on that 100 acres in Chisago County, a rural landowner in an ag classification could develop 20 units. If Representative Beard owns 100 acres elsewhere in the county and wishes to have greater density than his 20 units, under the ordinance allowed by state statute and adopted by the Chisago County Board, Representative Beard could purchase some of my development credits in my from my land and increase the density on his land. I might be able to sell him in an arm's length transaction 10 of my credits, so he could put 30 units on his 100 acres, excuse me. However, and this currently is in place, and we've had a few transactions that have proven that it's a useful tool for conservation. However, if my need for cash arises very quickly, usually because of health circumstances, I have a very difficult time finding a developer to purchase my credits during the few weeks or months that I all of a sudden need my cash. What the lack of a transfer development credits bank is in essence doing is forcing landowners to develop their land, even in this slow construction cycle, to sell to a developer for that cash. It's often not what a landowner wants, and it's often not what is the best use for that land and the most efficient use of that land. What House File 305 would do would be allow a county board or a municipality to establish a third-party transfer of development credits bank to whom I might go and see Representative Winkler to ask him if he would like to buy and hold my credits. And then when Representative Beard is able to or is interested in increasing the density on his development, he might go see the Winkler Transfer Development Credit Bank and see if there are credits available for purchase. That, in essence, is House File 305. The amendment would make sure that by establishing and legalizing transfer development credit banks in Minnesota, that we would not bar that arm's length transaction, direct two-party transaction between Representative Beard and myself. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment. I hope that we'll adopt it, and then we could hear some testimony, and I can see on members' faces that there are questions and that need to be answered.
Representative Kalin moves the A1 amendment. Discussion on the amendment. Representative Turner.
I just was wondering, what do credit unions and banks think about either the amendment or your bill in per se?
Mr. Chair, Representative Turner, the amendment was brought to us by the Builders Association of Minnesota with the concern they wanted to make sure that we just didn't bar the right that exists today by contract, that we couldn't allow a county to bar that arm's length two-party transaction. I think the response we've gotten generally from credit unions, community-owned banks, nationally chartered banks, has been one of interest. But because state law doesn't allow us to do any development credit bank currently, we haven't been able to engage any more deeply than that because they want to do what's only allowed by law.
Okay. Any more questions? Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is it's in the amendment and it's in the bill already. So. But I guess you're referring to the bank. I'm just curious if there's going to be this development credits bank. Is there a way to quantify the value of these credits? The credits going in, are they worth the same amount as the credits going out, or are these credits going to become a commodity of some kind? I guess I'm just kind of curious if we're kind of expanding that language here it's a bill, but it's also in the amendment here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland.
Representative Kalin.
I think one of the benefits of having a transfer development credit bank is that you do start to have a market player that is outside of the two-party transaction. We have had some development credits sold in Chisago County remarkably below what most people believe is the market value, and I believe $800 was the value of some of the, or the price of a few credits sold in the initial transfer. $800 severely underprices the true value of Representative Beard adding a unit to his development, where he might be able to gain 20, 50, maybe even at a very high end development, close to six figures on margin on that extra unit. And so the development credit bank allows market forces to intervene a little bit more clearly and make more transparent those transactions.
Representative Eastland.
Well, I guess then my question would be is where does the, if a market credit is sold for significantly more than it was purchased for, where does that money go?
Representative Kaling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eastman, I think you're getting directly to the market opportunity for either a nonprofit, as would be allowed, a 501c3, say a land trust organization, or credit union or privately held commercial bank to be engaged in this transaction as a means of adding to their profit and loss statement.
Representative Eastman.
So in what you're proposing here is that there is no control over that. So basically, that outside entity, nonprofit, or a bank, or a credit union, or a private enterprise of some kind, they can basically, this could be a business for them.
Representative Eastman, correct. I do think that this question of where I think you're going, if that's okay to maybe jump one step ahead for time's sake, is both the market maker and the kind of regulation. So how do we know the representative, I'm not going to pick on him because he's not here anymore, but Representative Pelosi is not going to buy my credit at $20,000 and sell it to Representative Beard at $60,000, three times markup. I think one is generally the market will take care of that and not allow for that to happen. I don't think Representative Beard would only do that if it makes sense. And hopefully you'd have more than one market player, ultimately more than one bank that could buy my credit. Number two, I'm certainly interested in any of my thoughts that, whether in this committee or before this comes to the floor, in ways that we can protect consumers by limiting either markup or interest or other ways of ensuring that we're not gouging landowners or developers through that markup.
Representative Eastman.
I guess I'm kind of reading the amendments and then reading the bill here, and in the bill you specify. Give some examples for when you say, or a private commercial enterprise, including but not limited to credit union or privately held commercial bank. But when you say including a not-for-profit organization, there is no examples of who that would be. Who is a not-for-profit organization that would be doing this if there's no profit? If they're not-for-profit? I mean, I guess my question is what would be their incentive for doing this? Is there some incentive? Who would be some likely candidates that would step up to the plate and do this? Is there the potential for some conflict of interest if we have a not-for-profit that's involved here that's going to be managing who can buy these credit-setting prices that maybe are beyond what somebody can afford? And can they set prices higher than they bought them for if they're a not-for-profit?
Representative Kaling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eastman, I'll walk backwards, I think, through those because I'd be amenable, like, as I said before, to figure out how to come up with some sort of reasonable limit on that, on the markup. I could certainly see, I know that the four existing transfer development credit banks in the United States are publicly managed, public agencies. In this case, Chisago County has clearly chosen not to to be the public bank, and they've expressed clearly. I have a couple of landowners and constituents here who've worked with the county and with me on this legislation on the concept. But I believe in those public development credit banks, they do allow for an administrative markup to cover the cost of administering a program. Nonprofit could be subject to that, although I could see it as a potential revenue stream. In terms of the nonprofits that I think could be interested, I worked very closely with the Minnesota Land Trust. Is that right? Trust for Public Land, excuse me. On a deal to preserve Camp Ojikita as a regional park in Chisago City that we've provided public financing for through the bonding bill this last year. They certainly don't make money by funneling grants through them to buy land and then sell it to Chisago City or local units of government. Their ethic and mission is about conserving land. That's why Land Trust would be interested in serving as a transfer development credit bank, and I've heard some interest by some of those land conservation groups in Minnesota. So it would be out of their to serve their mission.
would be their motivation.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Galen, I think that concerns me a little bit. Because, I mean, that's what we're talking about here is the conflict of interest. If somebody wants to be a land bank because being a land or being a credit bank can give them the ability to control how land gets. I mean, we're no longer in a free market. We're no longer in a marketplace where, in one sense, the credits can be bought and sold. If it's a for-profit, if it's a bank, the credits could be bought and sold based on the market that existed for them. If we're gonna go to a nonprofit that's going to have a mission of their own, and they're going to become a land credit bank so that they can advance their mission, I see a conflict of interest there. And I guess that just raises a red flag in my mind, and I think we should maybe explore that with some. Maybe somebody else has some questions. I'll stop here now, but that kind of gets to the root of some of the concerns I have.
If I could, very quickly, Mr. Chair.
Galen, simply.
I'd actually just point out that actually the market is not totally an enabled market today because we don't have the option. You only have the arm's length two-party transaction. As a landowner, I would have the option after we enact this legislation of doing more than just going out and enacting a conservation easement, selling my land, or holding on to my land. This actually provides a greater market opportunity, and that conflict of interest I don't think would exist because it's the same as buying a conservation easement. The question is the choice of the landowner in that transaction. I could choose to not sell to you if I believe that you're not a trustworthy organization. I do believe you are, so I would sell to you, but that's just I think there's more, there'd be more choices and the market would be more viable after we enact the bill.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, the line of questioning sort of continues on with Representative Eastland's thought. And I'm thinking, and looking at the language, we allow county boards to create these things and empower them, apparently. Just a technical question for Representative Kalin. Suppose in your scenario, I don't remember who was buying and who was selling, I need to buy some credits. You have land and you need the cash, so you sell your credits to Representative Winkler's holding company, and I go to buy them and find the guy. All right. I go to the development bank that somebody owns, find out the county board has changed the rules again. What's to prevent that from happening? Because I can see where a county board could empower someone. And we're playing by a certain set of rules, and all of a sudden the rules change in the middle of the transaction. I'm thinking, I need these, but I can't buy them right now, but I'll get them in a couple of years, and now the county's changed the zoning. Well, perhaps they take away the 1 in 10, 4 in 40, and it just, the Musa line comes my way, and I don't need them at all. So what does that do to the guy holding the credits? Because now they're diminished in value, I would think. Or maybe they change them and make them tighter, and I can't have them at all at any cost. That's a technical question. And there's a follow-up to that, but has this worked anywhere else where they've danced that dance and they know what's coming next or where these things are? You follow me?
I do, Mr. Chair, Representative Beard. I think your questions are right on point. I wonder if Lisa Frenette from the Builders Association of Minnesota might be able to elucidate from the research that they've done.
Good afternoon, Chair members.
Is this on the amendments or is this on the bill? Or I think you said the amendment was from BAM. Or
The amendment was brought to me by the Builders by BAM. But
would you like me to speak to the amendment or to the question?
Speak to the amendments, and then we can, or we can. Why don't we, if we want, we can take a put the. Why don't we vote to put the amendment on, and then we can speak to the whole bill. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Motion prevails.
Yes, thank
you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. I'm Lisa Frenette with the Builders Association of Minnesota. Just quickly, have you ever imagined you'd never have to learn about something in your life and then learn more about it in a couple of days? This would be one for me. Learn a lot about transfer development rights. Generally, Chairman Representative Beard, transfer development rights are inserted into a comprehensive plan. in the research that I've done, which would make it much more difficult for the rules to change midstream, and people would understand that that the rules are changing.
Well, Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, that helps a great deal, I think, for all of us to understand that if the county is administering this and it's part of their comprehensive plan, you just don't change that on a whim. There's a pretty lengthy process involved there. I'm going to change my line of questioning. I just have one other thought I'd like to express or concern I have, and that is the ability of non-governmental agencies to be involved here could introduce the whole business of ideological bias into this. Wealthy benefactors that sold their company and have hundreds of millions could move into an area, buy up development credits, and just make life miserable because they don't want any more development. I could see that happening. However, that would be a willing seller, willing buyer thing, I suppose, so people should go in with their eyes wide open. But I like the amendment we just adopted because it preserves private transactions outside of the development bank happening, which would also give us the ability then to perform to the comprehensive plan. Forgive me while I'm thinking out loud here and answering my own thought, but this is a committee, and this is what we do, is we ruminate on these things like this. But just know that as we move forward, that's a concern I have, that the ability for ideological monkey business here to subvert what we think we're doing. This could turn into cap and trade for land development, I guess is what it sounds like. But because it preserves, the amendment preserves the ability for private and willing sellers and buyers to transact business, I think we should be okay with it. So.
Okay. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kalin or any other testifier, I'm curious about examples or precedent for having a credit union or a commercial bank or anything else serve in this capacity. Is this a wholly new novel thing we're trying, which I'm not necessarily against. I'm just wondering if there are examples other places that we could maybe derive some lessons from.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start responding, and I hope that Tom O'Mara, licensed realtor in Chicago County, might come down because I think it, and add to my thoughts. But I think in this case, necessity is the mother of invention, where clearly public transfer development credit banks have worked in four other places, including King County, Washington, in Maryland, in Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Do I have that right?
Pennsylvania.
And New Jersey, excuse me, not Wisconsin, but New Jersey. I'm thinking of the other development tool in Wisconsin. But we recognize that the county has been overworked and understaffed in their zoning office and clearly not interested in managing. And we thought that the private market might be an interesting way to proceed. And I think maybe Mr. O'Mara might be able to articulate even more why.
Thank you. Could you please introduce yourself for the tape? And
sure. My name is Tom O'Mara. I live in Chisago County. I'm a realtor. I've been working on this particular issue in the county with landowners, with conservationists, and with others for the last 3 years. And what it comes down to really is you have to envision this as this transfer development bank as a MLS on steroids. It's an MLS in the sense that there'd be one place where you could find out exactly what these credits were selling for. So both the buyer and the seller would know exactly what things were worth. And second, it would act like a bank because it would be held in that place. So we guarantee to the person buying and selling that this certificate, which is like a stock certificate in many respects, would be protected, would not be duplicated, it would not be used fraudulently, it would be attached to the deed at the county, right? And so it protects both the buyer and the seller, and it preserves the right of individuals to make a transaction between one another as free parties, and it makes sure that those values are well known by all parties involved. I don't know if that answers the question, but...
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does help. I guess I wasn't totally clear from Representative Kalin's answer. So it sounds like in other entity or in other jurisdictions, the county itself is playing this role, but the idea here is that given limitations in county resources, that there may be a private entity who's willing to step up and do this. And I guess two follow-up questions. One would be, whether you've identified any, I guess there are people who are interested, but I don't know if you have any particular place in mind. And the second thing, just to conceptualize this, it's not really a bank. It is more of an exchange that you have in mind. It's more like a place to exchange these things, so that there's kind of standard rules for how they're exchanged and paper that can be followed to sort of track market trends and so on.
Yes. Mr. O'Meara.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, is it? There's no ATM at this bank, no cash. But what is important here is that the buyer and the seller have an opportunity to see exactly what it is that they're buying. And if you think about the Builders Association, imagine, if you will, a builder who says to himself, I would like to buy a large piece of land next to a city, and I would like to increase the density by a factor of, let's say, 2, because of the economics that work for me better than the current plan. He goes into Chisago County or some other county and says, I'm going to buy up enough credits here in this particular area to achieve that goal. Now, he could talk to the conservation people like the Trust for Public Land and say, I want to buy 150 acres with transit development credits. What land is it that you would like to preserve? And they could work together to buy up the land that everybody wants to preserve for the well-being of Minnesota, and at the same time then take those credits and use them to have development near the city where the city wants to have more dense development because it's more economical and they have city water and sewer right there. I mean, it's a win for everybody. It's a win-win all the way around. And with this bank established outside government, it has more flexibility to stay on mission, I think. And it has more motivation to stay on mission than it could probably make money for somebody.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Representative Scalzi.
Well, this is just about, thank you, Mr. Chair. Every time I hear a question asked and answered, it just pops up more questions. And I'm wondering, is this because of Ojikita? Is there another problem out there that we're not aware of? What is prompting this request?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Scalzi, it's independent of the Ojikita project, but I think other than the conservation goal of important scenic and cultural lands, I think it really grew out of probably about a 5 or 6 year long conversation that we've been having, building trust between traditionally conflicting interests of landowner rights and conservation environmentalist goals. And really a conversation at the coffee shop every Wednesday morning for a year and a half or 2 years, I think, before we really came to a point where, if I can toot my own horn even a tiny little bit, where the young kid on the block, actually, I stopped the conversation. I said, I believe that what we really need to do is not have more regulation in the comprehensive plan, but more tools and incentives for landowners to do something that they want to do but doesn't pencil out. And the transfer development credits option provides that willing buyer, willing seller relationship, but an opportunity to get return on the investment. Oftentimes, this is a 401k for most of our large landowners in exurban and greater rural areas. So, it's really out of an interest to provide another tool to save those critical resources and wildlife habitat in Chisago County.
And as a follow up, Mr. Chair, and then I guess my question is, what would happen in the future if there's excess development credit somewhere, and now and maybe there's no place to use them because maybe the city didn't really in fact get their sewer capability that they had wanted, and maybe they don't have the drinking water resources or whatnot. So then if there's excess development credits somewhere and no one can use them, then we're preventing someone from developing that had wanted to develop but can't because of differing changes, and comprehensive plans do change. I know it's difficult, and it takes quite a few votes, but times do change. We don't know if we're going to have an influx of residents, immigrants, or what's going to happen in the future, but what would happen if there were too many credits and no place to use them?
Mr. O'Meara.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi. If this occurred, then the developer who wanted to buy the credits, to use the credits, would have an opportunity to go to the county government where they have zoning and ask them to modify their rule on that particular set of credits and where that particular set of credits can be used. Hopefully, reasonable people will come to a reasonable agreement and those credits will be used. If not, whoever bought those credits made a bad investment. I mean, just that simple. I don't know how we could legislate against those kinds of changes if you look out over the next 20, 30, 40 years or to the end of the Republic. I mean, who knows? You just don't know.
That was end of Republic for longer than 40 years, right?
And or the end of the Republic, correct, right. Hopefully. God, yes.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple questions. For Ms. Dyson. These two provisions are enabling for counties and municipalities. I assume that they don't have that authority right now to do these ordinances, or do they?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, I don't believe they do.
Sure. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we're enabling them to adopt these provisions by ordinance, either the county or the municipality. My next question is, especially as it relates to the county board having authorization, what's the role of the township in all of this? Representative Kalin, what does this do to the township's ability to impact any of the decisions with regard to development in their township?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Dyson might be able to elucidate first and then...
Mr. Chair and Representative Lennon, I just wanted to clarify that under Chapter 462, municipality is defined to include townships. So this law also applies to townships.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then my question would be, if you've got an orderly annexation agreement between a township and a city, and you and it doesn't have any provision for how you treat these transfer development credits, what happens then? I mean,
Ms. Dyson, or Representative Kalin, or
I might be able to answer that. I think. If you read, I guess I'll have to look at the county provision first, Representative Lanning, if you read what would be now paragraph B, starting on line 1.23, that there in essence needs to be a sending area and a receiving area. It's described in currently in the county zoning enabling statute as areas from where the county, where preservation is considered by the board to be desirable, and two areas the board considers more desirable for development. So the counties have to determine, under the way that it works in Chisago County currently, and I believe that's consistent with the enabling statute, sending areas and receiving areas. I believe that the county has now adopted the countywide sending and receiving zone. Is that correct? I'm seeing nods of the head. And so that, I imagine your county is like mine and most others where the county board doesn't make many as like mine and most others where the county board doesn't make many zoning choices without strong input from township officials. Because the county really has the statutory authority and the township has very little, but they have a strong influence. In the case of those orderly annexation provisions, I think that credits could be, provided that it's a receiving area, credits could be purchased for development within that orderly annexation area. And orderly annexation is the same kind of arm's length, willing buyer, willing seller, willing annexer, willing annexee, if that's the right term. So I think it's really out of that cooperative relationship. And again, this being a voluntary tool, I think it fits nicely within the spirit of it.
Representative Lanning.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me ask the question this way. have the township, has the Township Association and the League of Cities, Association of Counties, are they familiar with what you're proposing here, and do they have a position, or have they taken a position with regard to this?
I'll leave it to Mr. Mayor or Mr. Whitney to describe what local township officers, after a great amount of scrutiny and discussion over the course of several years, we've been able to work closely with our township officers in Chisago County. I don't believe we've gotten a formal endorsement from the Township Association, and I see a representative from the League of Minnesota Cities coming, so hopefully we can have greater elucidation.
Sure.
Could I just add, Mr. Chair, our organization originally had, we have about 500 members who are landowners, conservationists, and others, and many of these people are also township officers. They own pieces of land that would be involved in this, and they all see this as a very practical and helpful solution for landowners with the financial needs.
Please identify yourself for the tape. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I know one of my coworkers, in fact, did talk on the Senate side with Senator Olstein, who has this bill. And as we read the bill, of course, it was permissive for cities, or this was enabling, to use Representative Lanning's words. So I came to watch the bill today and listen to the discussion as far as development issues go. We'd be glad to work with a number of you, or obviously with Representative Palin, on the bills that may be moved forward.
Okay.
Mr.
Representative Lanning.
If I might just make one last comment.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Lanning.
The whole issue, as you know, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, of the annexation has been a very contentious one between cities and townships. And my concern here is if this proposed legislation would further cause there to be concern or conflict with regard to annexation issues, and I would just like to hear from the townships and cities who are concerned about that issue that this isn't going to further complicate the annexation issue. That's my concern.
Representative Eastland, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back to the comment, it helped to kind of put it in perspective in my mind that this is an MLS on steroids. So this is more akin to a listing service rather than a bank that buys these things and owns them and then marks them up and sells them out. Is that what I'm hearing you say, that the organization that is going to service the bank isn't going to actually buy these things? They're just going to be the intermediary between a willing buyer and a willing seller and charge some kind of a commission?
Mr. O'Mara.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Mr. Eastland. The answer to that question is it could be both. The bank could buy and hold them. The bank could simply act as a facilitator between the buyer and the seller. It would depend upon the transaction. Each deal would be between a buyer and a willing buyer and a willing seller. In some cases, or let's say, for example, if the Trust for Public Land said we would like to acquire this large piece of land because we think it's an ancient forest here in Minnesota that should be preserved, we'll buy it through the bank. The bank will hold the certificates to make sure that, you know, everything stays copacetic, and then eventually along comes a buyer, a builder who would buy those credits and use them where they could be used in some receiving area.
Representative Eastland.
Okay, so then if we want to take the analogy of the MLS a little farther,
sure.
When something goes into the MLS, it goes in there listed at a price.
Yeah.
Is that what we anticipate here? The credits will always carry a value, so that value isn't going to be fluctuating depending on who's in the market out there to buy them?
They would not go into the bank until someone bought. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Excuse me on this process, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Eastland. What would happen is nothing would go into the bank until a transaction occurred. When that transaction occurred, it'd be noted that that particular unit sold for $20,000. The person coming down the line to buy the unit would know it sold for $20,000, whether it was last week or 2 years ago. So they would have some sense of what the market value was. And the fellow or woman with the farm who wants to sell their credits would know up front what these credits were selling for in their neighborhoods. And they'd have a better sense of what the market really was for their product.
One final question. We talked about Green Acres today on the House floor. I gotta get that in here too a little bit. So, if, for example, we aren't as fortunate as many seem to think we are that we're going to get this Green Acre thing fixed, we could end up with a lot of farms who, through circumstances, get reclassified. We end up with a lot of non-agricultural land that farmers are paying taxes on. That they may like to somehow relieve of their tax liability. So if I was a farmer and I lost my Green Acres and I have 50 acres here that I don't really want to sell, but I'd like to sell the development rights to it, and what would that do to the tax liability that I would face as the owner as I continue to own that property?
Representative Eastland? Representative Kalin? Looking the wrong direction.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland and I are not only seatmates, but we're identical twins, as you can tell. So I know it's hard to tell us apart.
That's not agreed to here.
Our voting record is quite similar as well.
That's my mistake.
Representative Eastland, I think, and I'm not an assessor and try not to play one on TV nor in the legislature, but that it would affect the classification or the highest and best use because it no longer could be developable, and so it would mitigate, it would decrease your tax liability. Second, I think that's a great example for how transfer development credits could be a real benefit because if someone is hit with the Green Acres payback, the 7 years payback, unfortunately, I do think we're going to change it, but if we were not to, that the transfer development credits tool may be a way for landowners to not have to lose their shelter belts or till lowlands illegally, perhaps even, but to get revenue to be able to pay that payback. I think it's a perfect example of the kind of pressures that sometimes happen.
Representative Turner.
Yes, I'm just, through our discussion, we're kind of finding the winners through the forest and that, but I'm wondering who are the losers, if any, at this point? I mean, who's opposing the bill? Who do you perceive to be losers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Turner, the losers are the landowners across the state who want to be able to use their transfer development credits rights and are not able to well enough today because of the slowdown on the development side and the difficulty in finding a willing buyer. You know, in terms of the losers, because it's enabling and it's only willing buyers and willing sellers, I think that addressing a couple of the technical tweaks here, the only loser possibly could be is if you have a bank that is a for-profit bank or otherwise gouging the market, and I think we have to find a way to put some limits on that. Otherwise, I don't know that there are any losers. I've not heard anybody oppose the bill.
Okay, thank you.
And with that, is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? And then I have one more question here. Identify yourself again.
Chairman, members, again, I'm Lisa Furnett with the Builders Association of Minnesota. We appreciate very much the fact that Representative Kalin has brought forth this bill and been willing to work with us to make sure that that no contract or two-party agreements get trumped through an ordinance that may come through in the transfer development rights. We do have several concerns about the bill. A lot of them have been addressed by members today. They include how will the credit bank be established? Is there a brokerage fee? Every time you raise the price on land or a house, you X somebody out of the market for being able to purchase a home. And that's pretty well established. We want to know if there's there will be a cap on the fee. Does the entity running the credit bank pay a portion back to the local unit of government if there's some sort of disparity? My example would be if a landowner sold their rights for $1,000 an acre right now, We're not in very good times right now, and they've been consulted for 4 or 5 years. They sold for more money. How would that money go back to the landowner? There's a couple things that I was thinking about as people were talking, and I was writing down notes with respect to Representative Scalzi's comment on having too many credits in a particular bank and not being able to use them. Perhaps we could do something with joint powers authorities allowing townships or cities or counties to go outside that area and use them with each other. So there's a lot of questions that we have. Again, we appreciate the fact that Representative Kalin's been willing to work with us on the bill and make it more of a market tool or more of a tool in the toolboxes. Representative Kalin uses a lot these days. Thank you.
Representative Kelsey, you had another question.
They did, Mr. Chair. And this to Mr. Finette's comments as well. Say I'm somebody that wants that has this beautiful property and I need some money, but nobody else wants to buy these development credits yet. I just am not sure how that would work. If I really need the money now and I want to preserve this wonderful property, I'm not a trust for public land, so I don't have deep pockets. Then what happens if I choose to establish some development credits, but nobody's ready to buy them yet? How do I get my money? And I think that was one thing that you talked about.
Kalin or Ms. Burnett?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, Representative Scalzi, you're actually articulating the need for that exchange or the bank, because right now, if I'm not ready to buy and you need the cash, then you have fewer options. It's not you don't have no other options, but you have fewer options. In this case, you could go to Representative Winkler, the Transfer Development Credits Exchange, and sell them. He could hold them, and when the market picks back up, I could go back and buy them from Representative Winkler.
Representative Scalzi.
But I guess, and maybe I missed this, but so say that I've sold them to Representative Winkler, and what do I get for them? That's the point. When do I get my money that I really need drastically right now for some reason? And he's going to develop the credits and hold them, but what? When do I get my money if there's nobody there that's a willing buyer? So he has ultimate cash assets that would enable him to pay me for those credits that would eventually be it would be an appropriate price down the road so that I didn't get really snookered on the deal.
And Representative Kalin, can you keep it short because we'd like to get out of here tonight and get the deal voted on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, you get paid at the time of sale to the bank.
Any further discussion? If not, Representative Kalin renews his motion that House File 305 be passed and recommended as amended, and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations, Reform, Technology, and Elections. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, and no further business. Meeting adjourned.